I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The semi-finalists for this year's James Beard Foundation Awards are being announced right here in Orlando this week at Audubon Park's East End Market. The James Beard Awards are sometimes called the Oscars for chefs and restaurants, and this is the first time the announcement ceremony has been held outside of its hometown in New York City. To talk about what this means for the growing culinary scene in Central Florida, I will speak to John Reif, founder of East End Market, Hari Pulapaka, owner and chef of Press and Deland, and Ricky Lee, publisher of the Tasty Chomps food blog. But first, last weekend jurors in Jacksonville found Michael Dunn guilty in four charges of attempted murder in the so-called Loud Music trial, but they failed to reach a verdict on the first-degree murder charge in the death of 17-year-old Jordan Davis. The case sparked comparisons to last year's trial of former Neighbourhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman. To talk about the issues, I'll be joined by Orlando Sentinel columnist Daryl Owens. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio now by Daryl Owens. Daryl has been with the Orlando Sentinel for over two decades. He's on the Sentinel's editorial board. He writes a once-weekly column on subjects ranging from education to human interest to social criticism. Daryl, welcome back to Intersection.
Always good to be here, Matthew.
Well, we're talking about the trial of Michael Dunn. First, I want to ask you, were you surprised by the way the verdict came back guilty on some of those charges but not guilty on first-degree murder?
Yes, I was surprised and disappointed. The way that the verdict came down, it kind of sends this dissonant message that it's okay to kill someone, but no, you can't shoot off a gun.
Well, last time you were on Intersection, Daryl, we talked about the issues of race and justice and injustice around the Zimmerman case. And you said at that point, this was before the George Zimmerman trial, you said at that point you thought there were people in Central Florida here to stir the pot. But you also said that you had a little more faith in the judicial process than others, and that was before that trial got underway. At this point now, after Mr. Zimmerman's acquittal and also after a mistrial on the murder charge in the trial of Michael Dunn, does this verdict change your views on the judicial system?
Well, that's a complicated question. I still have faith in the system. What I don't have faith in is the way that this particular case was presented. I think that the prosecution erred in presenting the hierarchy of charges that were available for the jury to choose from first-degree murder down to manslaughter. What it does, in my opinion, was suggest to the jury that, hey, they don't know what this guy did either, and they're just hoping that we can shoot fish in a barrel and pick the right charge. Mm-hmm. So I think they would have been better served to have either charged Mr. Dunn with second-degree murder, which would have been an easier charge for this jury to swallow, or to charge them with manslaughter rather than giving them a gamut of charges to pick from.
I understand that Angela Corey is saying she will retry that murder charge. Do you think they would be wise to go back and look at that and have a rethink about how they prosecuted it the first time?
Absolutely, but it seems that they never learned anything from the trial with George Zimmerman either, that they seem to have proceeded in this case in the same exact fashion that they did with George Zimmerman. They erred, I believe, in not humanizing Jordan Davis. Now, I'm not saying that we should have blamed the victim in this case because there was no blame for this young kid except that he had some bad manners, but that's not a death sentence in the United States. But I think they erred in not pointing out that this was a young man who had parents who loved him. He may have gotten involved in a culture, this quote-unquote hip-hop culture that is popular in the United States, but that does not make him a criminal. He's just a young man. You know, it's funny how the United States has evolved. Back in the 50s, James Dean was a rebel without a cause. But now young black men who adopt hip-hop music, who adopt hip-hop fashion, are automatically perceived to be thugs because of this. And there could be nothing further from the truth for a lot of these young men.
Do you think people in Central Florida were interested in the trial of Michael Dunn, or do you think there's some kind of fatigue around Stand Your Ground because of the amount of media hype surrounding the George Zimmerman case?
Well, I think people certainly were interested in it because of Stand Your Ground. They wanted to see whether this case was going to be another litmus test, because I guess you could argue, and again, I think there was a I think the jury reached the wrong verdict in the Zimmerman trial, but because the way that the law is constructed, even though that stand your ground was not argued, stand your ground was included in the jury instructions. Because of that, they reached the right verdict legally, but morally, I think it was the wrong verdict. But with this case, Jordan Davis, as I said earlier, was a young man who had a criminal record. You could argue that Trayvon had some brushes with the law, so he wasn't the perfect angel. But this young man simply used some foul language and perhaps ticked off someone, the wrong person in this case. So I guess people were following it to see if there would be a different outcome in this case, because this young man didn't have a criminal record, and you couldn't have accused him of, well, maybe he was up to something nefarious other than buying some snacks at a gas station.
Mm-hmm. Let me just read a quote in a newspaper article from Ron Davis. That's Jordan Davis's father. After the verdict, he said, "We don't accept a law that would allow our children to be regarded as collateral damage." Is that a fair portrayal of the law, that the fact that it allows children to be regarded as collateral damage? Would you say that's a fair assessment of it?
Yes, actually I would, and that's my problem with this. I recently wrote about this in a column, that the way Stand Your Ground is changing our society, we seem to be developing, to quote, I guess, Pink Floyd, this kind of numbness, uncomfortable numbness about death. And what Stand Your Ground does is it encourages people to shoot first and maybe ask questions later. And in a lot of situations like this one, you get hotheads like Mr. Dunn apparently was, who are armed and dangerous. And I think Mr. Davis is absolutely right, that when you have a law that encourages you to shoot first rather than to retreat and regroup, you're going to have situations where children or anyone else is going to become collateral damage.
Let me read another quote. Now, this is from Angela Corey, again, after the trial. She said, "A person who believes they're in imminent danger doesn't have to see something, i.e. an actual weapon, but there has to be reasonable fear, and that's the way Florida law reads." Do you think, in light of this, is there any chance of developing any kind of momentum for another look at Stand Your Ground or another look at the self-defense laws here in Florida?
In a reasonable state, yes, but I'm not so sure that that's going to happen here in Florida. And that is, you know, certainly one of the fatal flaws with Stand Your Ground, is this word perception. You know, what I perceive to be dangerous versus what someone else perceives to be dangerous, you know, it's a nebulous thing here. He claims to have seen a young man with a shotgun. Perhaps he thought he did, or perhaps, you know, he's spinning a nice little yarn there. We can't allow people to be immunized from prosecution because of perception.
He is guilty nonetheless on some of those charges, attempted murder, facing a pretty long jail sentence for that. Do you think there's a measure of justice in this?
Well, that goes to, I guess, the bittersweet nature of this. Yes, it is great that Mr. Dunn is going to serve some time in prison, probably a very long time, for the other charges. But as many other commentators have pointed out, that the one charge for a young man who is dead is the one that he is not being punished for. And that speaks loudly to, again, the notion of the value of not only black life, but life itself. Because, as I wrote recently, it's not only white people who carry guns. Black people have guns as well. And suppose they're in a situation where they perceive themselves in danger, rightly or unusually wrongly, as in this case. You know, there may be, and this is probably going to be inflammatory, but I don't think the law is going to change until there is an Opie Taylor who gets shot by some guy who looks like Willie Horton. That's when people are going to start looking at this law and going, wow, is this really the way we want to go? Do we really want a society that is using biases, perceptions, and prejudice as a gauge as to who's going to live and who's going to die?
Now, anti-gun lobbyists and some outspoken critics have stand your ground, including the Reverend Al Sharpton, for one, renewing calls to fight to try and change Florida's self-defense laws. Do you think we're likely to see some protest action this spring in Florida over this issue?
There's certainly a possibility of it, but frankly, I hope that the gentleman that you just mentioned, Mr. Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, aren't leading this, because people have such an animus against these two gentlemen that any kind of constructive outcome from this is going to be muted, because people are going to be looking at who's leading this. We need to have some grassroots leadership on these issues, and at least that's my hope.
Where do you think that grassroots leadership might come from?
Well, hopefully there are enough people out there who have seen enough. You know, there are men and women who are mothers and fathers who should be able to see that, hey, this could be my child. And again, it's not a racial matter. It's just a matter of a child coming into contact with the wrong person at the wrong time, and that I don't want this to happen to my child, and maybe it's time for me to get involved, to speak up.
I've been speaking to Daryl Owens. He's on the Orlando Sentinel editorial board and writes a once weekly column. Daryl, thank you very much for joining us on Intersection.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
Still to come on Intersection, a conversation with East End Market founder John Rife, Crest restaurant chef and owner Hari Pulapaka, and Ricky Lee, publisher of the Tasty Chomps food blog. We'll talk about Central Florida's culinary scene and the James Beard Awards semi-finalist announcements here in Orlando. I'm joined in the studio by John Rife. John is the owner of East End Market. It's a neighborhood market and food hub in Audubon Park, and host of the announcement of this year's James Beard Foundation Awards semi-finalist. John, thank you very much for joining us.
Very happy to be here.
Also joined by Hari Pulapaka. Hari is the owner of Crest Restaurant in historic DeLand, Florida. He's a two-time James Beard nominee for Best Chef in his region. Hari, thank you very much for making the trip out here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us in the studio is Ricky Lee. Ricky runs the Tasty Chomps food blog. He's also the author of The Food Lover's Guide to Orlando, the best restaurants, markets, and local culinary offerings. Ricky, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Matthew.
John, I want to start with you. This week, of course, marks a historic event for the city of Orlando, playing host to this James Beard announcement. Why do you think Orlando was selected this year?
There are so many things to be excited about that have happened in the last few years and are coming to happen in Central Florida food. The fact that we're getting some national attention for the chefs that are really doing innovative things with food. They're superlative in the way they source. And the fact that we have such a long growing season here means that we have the ability to source vegetables that other parts of the country, you know, have to get out of season. So I think we have a lot of fresh produce. We have a lot of thoughtful and thought-provoking chefs that are doing it for all the right reasons. And then the flavor profiles are really diverse here. So I think we offer a lot. You know, we're still a very diverse city with a lot of different flavors due to being close to a lot of places via airplane. I think there's just a lot of noteworthy things about the local food scene that, you know, tickle the fancy at a national level.
Success usually doesn't happen overnight. This has been a long time brewing. Do you feel like it's taken too long for Florida and Orlando, Florida, to really hit the attention of restaurant writers and critics and kind of garner more popular support?
I think, you know, you look at, we do so many things at a superlative level when it comes to entertainment and the tourism industry, that it's very easy to write about that stuff. And it's such a, we're scoring so many points there that it's often, you know, why write about anything else, because it's just easy to write about. I think as national media starts going, hey, we want to turn over rocks, we want to discover things, they start turning over rocks in Orlando and go, oh my gosh, look at this undiscovered chef who's, he could just be a food truck purveyor and it's just amazing food. And so as they've turned over rocks, you know, as a culture, we're shifting. We want those aha moments. You know, everyone's heard about the attractions. There's what's new and what's happening. And, you know, thanks to, you know, blogs like Tasty Chomps, we're starting to discover what's here. And the national, you know, media and people interested in Orlando go, I'm coming to an attraction, but what else is there?
Well, Hari, let me ask you, just explain, put it in context, what do the James Beard Foundation Awards mean?
They're obviously extremely well-known in the food community, not just in this country, but all over the world. The common catchphrase that's used to describe the significance of that award is that it's like winning an Oscar for acting or some other creative endeavor. And it truly is that because it's even presented in that same format. But in all seriousness, it's the James Beard Awards are a testament to one's creativity and significance and impact on all things culinary, beginning in a region and perhaps even nationally. But it's determined by not a popular award. It's not determined by a secret ballot that has nothing to do with food. It's from what all I know and understand, and I've gotten to know more and more about the James Beard Foundation in the past few years, has everything to do with a true cataloging of one's contributions to the food scene. And so it's a legitimate testament to one's creativity.
Is it the kind of award or even the kind of nomination where people hear about it and they'll come from other parts of the country or other parts of the world to your restaurant to try out your food because they know about the award?
Certainly the foodies would know about the awards. In fact, it's quite a buzz the day of when nominations are announced, whether it be the semifinalists, and this is the first time, as you may know, that the semifinalist announcements are being made outside of New York City. So that's a significant consequence of this event here in Orlando. But the process of determining the ultimate winner is, in theory, dependent on actual visits by judges of national stature, and they actually should be tasting your food and reporting back to the foundation or the committees involved in the foundation about who really should be moving up the ladder. I'm not sure if that always happens, depending on where the region is, but hopefully this year in Central Florida, all of the nominees at the semifinal stage will be put under the scrutiny of actual judging and tasting of their food.
Ricky, what kind of changes are you seeing in Orlando's culinary scene, and how is that changing the city's image?
I think especially in the past, 20 years or so, it's become more and more diverse. You know, different enclaves and pockets of ethnic communities have risen up and shared their food from their parts of the world with people here in Orlando. And as John referenced earlier, Orlando has been referred to as sometimes as the breadbasket of Florida, you know, Central Florida, and we're surrounded by sea on all sides, you know, with great fisheries and everything. So they use those great local ingredients to create amazing food.
Is Orlando getting a reputation as a food destination? You know, Harry was talking about foodies knowing about the James Beard Awards, but what about people just, you know, figuring out that Orlando's got some pretty good dining spots, maybe on Urban Spoon or some of those other websites? What's the reputation of Orlando like amongst tourists, do you think?
I think especially with, like you said, like those apps, Urban Spoon and Yelp, and those tourists who are more foodie influenced, for example, like the conventioners who come and they're looking for good food, and they find all these reviews online, and they're like, okay, maybe I'll try it outside of the regular chain restaurants.
Well, John, let me ask you, the East End Market's it's the first of its kind in this area here in Central Florida. You talked about the urban garden, really trying to build up the idea of people going local in terms of where they get their food from, where they dine, where they shop, and where they eat. How big a deal is it having the James Beard Awards here and especially at the East End Market?
I mean, for me on a personal level, it's completely silly, meaning it's testament to the fact that we've brought together folks that, as Hari mentioned, the award is about great food, but it's also about the ethos that it's done by and the impact that they have in their community. I mean, you know, Hari is very involved outside of what he does in creating an environment where the good food movement can grow, where people are eating whole foods and locally sourced and seasonal. And chefs like Kevin Fonzo are working with the Edible Schoolyard projects. And so, you know, we've brought together a lot of food artisans that kind of speak to that ethos, that they are passionate about what they do. Our cheesemonger will talk to you for 3 hours about the difference between goat cheese and cow cheese. And so for being in love with Orlando, period, it is such an honor that they would come to Orlando and just Central Florida or Florida in general, that the first time they're doing this outside of, you know, New York is here is really exciting. And it really hopefully brings national attention to the fact that there are wonderful things that are happening here, that there's a really sense of community and camaraderie. And I think they recognize that. You know, the salon that Hari helped organize a couple weeks ago out at Lake Meadow Naturals was a deeply impactful thing for a lot of us. You know, chefs, journalists, just going, how do we move the ball forward? And the fact that they saw enough value in coming and giving their time to us to help nurture our nascent food scene is really a powerful thing.
when you look at the way food's moved around the country, when you talk about the natural fact that we have a good agriculture scene here in Florida, but there is, obviously, if you go to a supermarket, you'll see, you know, produce from all over the place, all over the country, all over the world. Do you think you're fighting a bit of a quixotic battle with the market you've got there?
The windmill, the Don Quixote?
Exactly.
you know, it's funny because when this all started, or when, you know, guys like Michael Pollan started making people aware that there was something wrong with our industrial food system, you know, the catchphrase was, hey, a carrot travels 1,500 miles from farm to plate. But when you look at it on a larger scale and you put all the carbon footprint stuff in there, that's only 30% of the problem. The other 70% is us driving to the supermarket. So the more we can get producers closer to the consumer. So my real big push is growing growers, is getting younger people passionate about growing spectacular food and getting it closer to the end consumer. So we farm, all of our growing happens right within the city, within, you know, a 3 or 4 mile radius of these restaurants. So a lot of it is that impetus, and then getting away from the use of, you know, the broad spectrum petrochemicals, herbicides, and fertilizers. When you're growing in a small, controlled environment, you just don't need all that stuff. The attention and care, just like Hari gives to his food, I give that to my garden, and that's what we're teaching people, is that it's not complicated. We have a great growing season. Just get started, and then you just learn along the way. So I think there's a big movement for that here, getting the production of the food closer to the end consumer.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. I'm speaking to food blogger Ricky Lee, Chef Hari Pulapaka, and East End Market founder John Reif. You can join the conversation by sending us an email to intersection@wmfe.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Hari, you talk about, you know, your restaurant being sort of on the periphery. DeLand, I suppose, is a little bit off the beaten path. Are people beating a path to DeLand to go to your restaurant and other restaurants in the area?
I would hope so. I mean, I can tell you in a significant percentage of our guests, at least on weekends, are definitely not from Volusia County. And that leaves out even the coastal areas. So yes, the awards and the nominations and all of those things definitely spike the attention level for our little restaurant. And the good news is, for me, it's still the same dining space of 40 seats. And when we don't have a seat, we don't have a seat, whether you're a judge for the James Beard Foundation or you're the, you know, the lieutenant governor, the new lieutenant governor for the state of Florida.
Whereabouts where do you go to get your produce? I mean, John Reif talks about going local and finding things that are grown here in the breadbasket of Florida. Is that an ethos that drives your restaurant, where you get your food from?
It does. When we first opened the restaurant, I convinced a farmer in town to set aside a plot of her space and call it the Crest Garden. And I went and created this nice logo and built the sign, and we stuck it in the ground and called it the Crest Garden. We don't have a garden in historic downtown DeLand, garden space, I should say. So since day one, I practiced what I knew growing up in India, where you went to the market every day and you bought produce for just that day. You didn't accumulate all this stuff in a refrigerated environment. You just went and you shopped in the morning and you cooked during the day. And you shopped in the morning, you cooked. That's the MO that I'm used to my entire life. So to do it any other way was unthinkable for me.
Mm-hmm. John, do you think Orlando has its own distinctive cuisine, or Central Florida?
You know, it's interesting. I grew up, you know, hunting and fishing, and we ate a lot of wild game. And it's, you know, people go, in Florida, isn't it just palm trees? So, you know, we grew up in what's euphemistically called the cracker culture. I mean, we grew up on 10,000 acres of land between here and Cocoa Beach. So my upbringing was very, you know, pull up, you know, trying to figure out what could we eat. Like, we would like literally boil, you know, acorns and see if we could eat them. And then we'd pull up cattails and eat the base like something like watercress. So having a father that grew up in the Keys, Florida food was just part of who we were. We didn't know any different. But he came to Florida via Alabama, and so we had homemade mayonnaises and stuff like that. So I think what's really unique about Orlando, and the same thing that's unique about New York, is that, yes, you want to experience the unique culture of that place, but once you've done it, then what? So if we had every restaurant just was this one theme, it doesn't become a destination anymore. I think the beauty of what's happening in Central Florida is that we do have people like James and Julie from Cask and Larder that are, you know, doing things that are really pushing Southern food forward. You know, you go to Hari's restaurant and it's Indian infused, but it's really approachable and it's really fresh and it's, you know, it's tasty in a way that doesn't make you feel like you're in a, you know, traditional curry shop. So I think the fact that we have some diversity is great. But, you know, we spoke about this at the James Beard Salon, is what is our food culture? And maybe it's just that it's a cornucopia because of our extended growing season and being a peninsula and having access within 100 miles, you know, coast to coast. I mean, people talk about the 100-mile diet. Well, we're blessed. I mean, we've got both coasts, which have totally different types of ecosystems for the seafood. We've got marshlands and highlands and grass, and, you know, and we're really blessed with the ability to produce quite a bit of food in this state. And I think it's like the second leading industry in the state. So while I think it would be nice to have something that is our signature thing, I don't think it's bad that we don't. Maybe it's that maybe our joy is that we don't, and that there's just a variety of things to get to sample.
Do you think there's a tendency, though, if you're a city like Orlando, is there a tendency to try and compare yourself to other cities that have already kind of made it on the international food scene?
Yes and no. I think, yes, you have to compare. I mean, parents do it whether they want to or not. Well, how old was your child when they started walking? So you're always going to – that's human nature. But I think there are a lot of things that we're doing that are unique that make us, you know – like I said, worthy of emulation. So I think the comparison doesn't necessarily need to happen. Maybe the exciting thing is that we don't compare. But, I mean, even with East End, we went and looked at 15 or 20 public markets around the country and took the best practices from those different places and made something completely unique here. So I think we have the opportunity to do that, you know, in all aspects of the food industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you kind of the same question, Harry. Do you think it's going to take a lot to maybe elevate Central Florida or Orlando onto the same level as, say, I don't know, like a Miami in terms of dining or, you know, a New York City? Or is that just a silly question?
There may be some of that at apples versus oranges in that question. But I don't think it's going to take time to elevate Orlando specifically. It's going to take time to tell the others about Orlando in the way we want them to know us. So, and events like this are going to go a long way in doing that. Once they get here, you know, depending on where they choose to, how they choose to experience the region, has something to do with the tourism board and the kinds of contacts that they have once they get here, who leads them where and who recommends what. But if they are able to experience, you know, a wide enough variety of what Central Florida has to offer, I think they will leave with a sense of that this place is legitimate in its attempt to not only think about food thoughtfully, but actually excite the palate and not just be, you know, trying to emulate somebody else. So we're not trying to emulate anybody. Having said that, as professionals, we're always inspired by things that are done better than what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that comes from our own region or it comes from halfway around the world, so be it.
Ricky, do you think Orlando needs to be looking to other cities for inspiration, or do we have enough going on here that we can do it on our own?
Well, I think we definitely have enough on our own, can stand on our own two feet.
I've been speaking to Ricky Lee. Ricky runs the Tasty Chomps food blog. He's also the author of Food Lover's Guide to Orlando, the best restaurants, markets, and local culinary offerings. Ricky, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, man.
And we've also been speaking to Harry Pulapaka. He's the owner of Crest Restaurant in historic DeLand, Florida, and he's a two-time James Beard nominee. Harry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And also John Reif. John is the owner of the East End Market, the Neighborhood Market and Food Hub in Audubon Park. John, thanks for coming in.
You bet, Matthew. Thanks for having us.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.